A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Dark Nest One, The Joiner King, by Troy Denning. Read for you by Jonathan Davis. Evening had come to Unity Green, and the first hawkbats were already out, dipping down to pluck yamel gels and koofy eels from the rolling whitecaps on Liberation Lake. On the far shore, the Yorick coral bluffs that marked the edge of the park had grown purple and shadowed. Beyond them, the durasteel skeletons of the rising sky towers gleamed crimson in the setting sun. The planet remained as much Yuuzhan Tar as Coruscant, and in many ways that would never change. But it was at peace. For the first time in Luke Skywalker's life, the galaxy was truly not at war, and that counted for everything. There were still problems, of course. There always would be. And today, several senior masters were struggling to address the chaos that Jaina and four other young Jedi Knights had caused by abruptly abandoning their duties and departing for the unknown regions. Lobaka was the only one who completely understood the biomechanics of the Maladoth, Corrin Horn was saying in his throaty voice. So, as you can see, the Ramoan relocation project has ground to a complete standstill. Luke reluctantly shifted his gaze from the viewport to the council room speaking circle, where Corrin stood using a laser wand to highlight the holographic projection of a huge Yuuzhan Vong slave ship. Corrin flicked the laser wand, and the holograph switched to the image of a blast-pocked asteroid miner. The situation in the Maltorian mining belt is deteriorating as well. Without Zek there to lead the hunt, Three-Eyes pirates have the run of the system. Raw material shipments have fallen by 50%, and Replanet Hab is trying to buy them off. That's one circuit we need to kill now, Mara said. Seated in the chair next to Luke's, she was, as usual, the first to cut to the heart of the matter. If rehab conglomerates start buying off pirates, we'll have marauders popping up all over the core. The other masters voiced their agreement. Fine, Corrin said. Where do we find a replacement for Zek? No one rushed to answer. The Jedi were spread too thin already, with most Jedi Knights, and even some apprentices, already assigned three tasks. Finally, Kip Duren said, The Solos should be finished on Borau soon. Maybe Replanet Hab will be patient if they know they're the Solos' next assignment. Strictly speaking, the Solos were not available for assignments. Han wasn't even a Jedi, and Leia's status was completely informal. The Council just kept asking them to help out. They just kept doing it, and every master in the room knew the Order had been exploiting the Solos' selfless natures for far too long. Someone else needs to contact them, Mara finally said. It's getting so bad that Leia cringes whenever she sees Luke's face on the holocom. I can do it, Kip offered. I'm used to making Leia cringe. A subtle eddy in the Force drew Luke's attention toward the entrance. He raised a hand to stop the discussion. Excuse me. Perhaps we should continue this later. We don't want Chief Omus to know how concerned we are about Jaina's departure. We don't? No. Luke rose and started toward the door. Especially not when he's bringing Chiss. Barely a moment passed before the door hissed open and a young apprentice came to a surprised halt directly in front of Luke.
Master Skywalker,
the young Rodian stammered.
Chief Omus and...
I know, Twool. Thank you. Luke stepped into the doorway and found himself looking at Chief of State, Cal Omus, and a trio of blue-skinned Chiss. With a wrinkled face and sagging jowls, the Chiss in front was probably the oldest Luke had ever seen. The two in the rear were clearly bodyguards. Tall, strong, alert, and dressed in the black uniforms of the Chiss Expansionary Defense Fleet. Chief Omus, Luke said.
Welcome. You're expecting us.
Omus cast a pointed glance into the conference room.
Good.
Luke bowed to the elderly Chiss,
And Aristocra Mitzwekleone. It's a pleasure to make your acquaintance. The Chiss's red eyes narrowed to crimson lines.
Very impressive. It's not easy to gather identity files on Chiss aristocracy.
We haven't. Luke smiled and continued to block the door. You and your bodyguards are welcome to come inside once you have removed your hidden weapons. Omas cringed visibly, but Luke did not move. Mitzquecleone smiled like an old man caught sipping something against his doctor's orders, then pulled a small holdout blaster from his boot and passed it to a bodyguard. Luke stepped aside and waved the two statesmen toward the conference circle. Please join us. At the conference area, the Jedi Masters rose to greet their guests. Everyone knows Chief Omas, I think. Luke motioned Omas into a chair. This is Aristocra Mitzwekleone from the Chiss Empire.
Please use my core name, Swek,
the Aristocra instructed.
Of course, Luke said.
Swek has some disturbing news for us, I believe. Swek's wrinkled brow rose.
Then you know the purpose of my visit?
We can sense your apprehension through the Force, Luke said.
I assume it concerns our Jedi in the unknown regions.
Indeed it does, he said. The Chiss Ascendancy requires an explanation.
An explanation?
Corrin was not quite able to conceal his indignation.
Of what?
We demand an explanation of your actions, of course. What happens on our frontier is no concern of yours.
The Chiss Frontier Aristocra?
Saba Sebatine, one of the newest Jedi Masters, asked.
Of course.
Swek turned to the barrable.
You don't know what your Jedi Knights have been doing, do you?
It appears I have no business here after all.
Obviously, the Jedi involved in this matter are acting on their own.
Involved in what matter? Kip asked. That is of no concern to the Galactic Alliance, Swek said.
My apologies for taking so much of your time.
No apologies are necessary, Luke said. Anything in which our Jedi Knights involve themselves concerns this council.
Then I suggest you do a better job supervising them in the future.
Swek turned to Omas.
I'm quite finished here, Chief.
Of course, Omas said. An escort will meet you at the temple entrance.
I believe I need to have a word with these Jedi. In that case, I'll thank you for your hospitality now.
Omas waited until the Aristocra was gone, then scowled at Luke.
Well?
Luke spread his hands. At this point, Chief Omas, you know more than we do.
I was afraid of that.
Apparently, a team of Jedi have involved themselves in a border dispute with the Chiss.
How can that be?
Mara asked. Their destination was over 100 light years from Ascendancy space.
Then our Jedi are out there, Omas said. What in the blazes for? We can't spare one Jedi at the moment, much less seven.
Mara's green eyes looked ready to loose a stream of blaster bolts.
Our Jedi, Chief Omas? Forgive me.
The Chief's voice was more placating than apologetic.
I didn't mean to imply anything.
Of course not, Mara said.
She turned to the rest of the council. Mitzwekleone said, seven Jedi. What do we make of that?
This one only counts five.
Saba lifted her hand and began to raise her taloned fingers.
Jaina, Alima, Zek, Lobaka, and Tessar.
Kip added two fingers. Tekli and Tahiri? Omas frowned.
How could you know that?
I thought they were with Zonama Seacut in the unknown regions.
They're supposed to be, Corrin said. But, like the others, they're also Murker survivors.
I don't understand, Omas said. What does this have to do with the Murker mission?
I wish we knew, Luke said.
Undertaken in the middle of the war with the Yuuzhan Vong, the Murker mission had been as costly as it had been successful. Anakin Solo and his strike team had destroyed the enemy's Jedi-killing Voxen, but six young Jedi Knights had died in the process, including Anakin himself, and another was missing and presumed lost. All I can tell you is that for several weeks, Jaina and the other survivors of that mission reported feeling a call from the unknown regions.
On the day they left, that call became a cry for help. And since we know Tenel Ka is still on Hapes, Mara explained, it seems likely the extra Jedi are Tekli and Tahiri.
What about Zonama Sekot?
Omas asked. Zonama Sekot was the living planet that had agreed to serve as home to the defeated Yuuzhan Vong.
Could the call have come from it?
Luke shook his head. Zonama Sekot would have contacted me directly if it needed our help. I'm convinced this has something to do with the mission to Merkur.
Oma stayed silent, waiting for more of an explanation, but that was all Luke knew. Instead, Luke asked, what did Mitzwa Cleone tell you?
Omas shrugged.
He demanded to know why the Galactic Alliance had sent its Jedi, his words, to interfere in a Chiss border dispute. When he saw how surprised I was, he demanded to speak to you.
This is bad, Mara said. Very bad.
I agree,
Omas said.
Either he thinks we're all lying, or he believes our Jedi Knights have gone rogue.
Saba finished.
In either case, the result will be the same.
They'll try to solve the problem themselves, Omas said.
How hard will this be on them?
Our Jedi Knights can take care of themselves, Luke said.
I know that, Omas snapped. I'm asking about the Chiss.
If the Chiss take action against them, Jaina and the others will attempt to defuse the situation, for a time, Luke said. After that, it depends on the nature of the conflict.
But they won't hesitate to meet force with force, Mara clarified. Nor would we ask them to.
If the Chiss push things, sooner or later, Jaina is going to bloody their noses.
Omas paled and turned to Luke.
You need to put a stop to this, and soon. We can't let it come to killing.
Luke nodded.
We'll certainly send someone to...
No, I mean you personally.
Omas turned to the others.
I know the Jedi have their own way of doing things, but with Jaina Solo leading those young Jedi Knights, Luke is the only one who can be sure of bringing them home.
That young woman is as headstrong as her father. For once, nobody argued.
A silver splinter shot across the Falcon's bow, 3 kilometers ahead and hanging just below the clouds, then disappeared into a fog bank almost before Han Solo realized what he had seen.
Did you see that?
As Han spoke, he kept both hands on the control yoke. With fangs of gray mist dangling beneath a low gray sky, and spires of vine-covered Yorikaral rising from a floor of undulating forest, Borau was a dangerous planet to map. Deadly, even.
You told me this planet was abandoned.
It is abandoned, dear. Leia glanced at the console in front of the co-pilot seat, then shook her head in disgust at the static-filled array. The sensors can't get a reading through these ionized clouds, but we know what kind of vessel that was.
And you say I jumped to conclusions?
Despite Han's protest, his heart was sinking. Since the Derelict Planet Reclamation Act had passed, there seemed to be more survey ships in the galaxy than stars. The view from the stern vidcam appeared on Han's display, showing the knobby little cone of a Cone-Sayer mapping skiff. It was in the middle of his screen, dead center.
He's following us.
So it would seem, Leia answered. The good news is he hasn't been there long or I'd have seen him. Han pushed the throttles forward and the forested ridges below began to flash past in a verdant blur. Maximize the rear shields. Cone-Sayer just delivered a fleet of armed mappers to replanet Hab, so things might get rough.
Han, what the blazes are you doing? I'm tired of getting kicked around by these replanet Hab pilots. It makes me look old.
Han took the Falcon into a wisp of low-hanging cloud. Normally, he would have circled around it to avoid the small risk of hitting one of the strange spires the Yuuzhan Vong had left scattered across the planet. But that would have required a second mapping run around the other side, and they simply did not have the time. Not if they wanted to beat these claim jumpers at their own game. When the Falcon came out the other side without crashing into anything, their passenger gasped in relief and pushed his T-shaped head between the seats.
Captain Solo, there is no sense placing your ship at risk.
Azam Nor spoke with the mouths on both sides of his arched neck, giving his Ithorian voice a mournful stereo quality.
DPRA regulations state that when two parties file simultaneous claims, the Reconstruction Authority must give preference to the one with greater resources. My people do not have the means to match even a small rehabilitation conglomerate, much less one like Replanet had.
You're young, so maybe you don't know this, Han retorted. But I don't usually obey regulations. Leia laid her hand over Han's. Han, I hate losing to these world grabbers as much as you do, but Azam is right. The Ithorians don't have...
Look, we can do this, Han said.
A vast fog bank appeared on the horizon, its misty hem dragging in the treetops.
Borau isn't an easy world to map, and we have a big head start.
And the Reconstruction Authority has to log every claim it receives. Han eased the control yoke back and started to climb above the oncoming fog bank. Risking a small wisp of cloud was one thing, but even he would not fly blind through who knew how many kilometers of dense fog.
If I can talk Lando into sponsoring us, we still have a chance. All we have to do is transmit our map first.
Leia remained silent.
Okay, so it's a small chance, Han said, but it's better than nothing. And it's not like we haven't bet on long shots before.
Han, Leia laid her hand on his and pushed the control yoke forward again, ending their climb. We don't have time to waste recalibrating the terrain scanners.
Are you crazy?
He studied the atmosphere ahead with a nervous eye.
You are. You're crazy.
I thought you wanted to win this thing.
I do, Han said. And to do that, we need to stay alive.
Captain Solo makes an excellent point,
C-3PO said.
Without our sensors working properly, our chances of hitting an abandoned watchtower in those clouds are approximately...
Don't quote me odds, 3PO, Leia said. I need to concentrate. She focused her attention on the gray curtain ahead, and whirls of fog began to peel away from the center. By the time they reached the fog bank, Leia had opened a long channel down the center, a very narrow channel, not much wider than the Falcon itself. C-3PO's electronic voice split the tense silence.
Oh, my!
Quiet, 3PO! Han barked. Leia needs to concentrate.
I'm aware of that, Captain Solo, but the route she is clearing has opened a small path through the ionic interference. We seem to be receiving an in-system comm transmission from Master Durin.
Kip's voice came over the comm speakers, scratchy and distorted.
It'll melt your circuits from the inside.
Take it easy, kid. You're on, Han said. And this had better be good.
I wish this could wait, but I'm only passing through on my way to Ramodi.
The Baradium ring? Han asked. I thought Tesser Sebatine was supposed to handle that.
Supposed to is right.
Kip paused a moment.
Something came up.
Bigger than smuggling Baradium?
Hard to say. When you're done here, the Council needs you and Leia to take over in the Maltorian system.
Nice of them to ask, Han grumbled into the comm mic.
That's what I'm doing now. The Council doesn't give orders, especially to you two.
Could have fooled me, Han said. What happened to Zek? Is he okay?
Zek's fine, but something came up and he had to leave.
Alarm started to go off inside Han's head. Jaina had told them about the mysterious call that she and the other strike team members had been feeling from the unknown regions.
Listen, we didn't want to ask you again, but this is important. Replanet Hab is about ready to start paying 3i off.
I'll have to talk it over with Leia. Red Star's tribunal ought to be just about over, and we were hoping to catch up with Jaina for a few days before she goes out again.
A blurry sliver of green murk appeared at the end of the fog channel that Leia was holding open. Her gaze remained dead ahead. Han hoped that she was actually seeing, that she had not sunk so deeply into her trance she would fail to notice the hazy stripe of darkness ahead.
Seeing Jaina might be a problem?
Don't tell me. Han said. Something came up.
The hazy strip ahead thickened into a sharp, distinct streak. Something in the unknown regions, I'll bet.
Well, yes.
Thanks for letting us know, Han snorted. What's the situation?
We don't know exactly, but there's no reason to worry. Master Skywalker has taken Mara and Saba to investigate.
Now Han was worried. To draw three masters away, the problem had to be serious.
All right, kid, Han said.
The dark streak at the end of the fog channel had grown sharp enough to identify as a Yorick coral spire.
What aren't you telling us? Nothing.
Han remained silent, and finally Kip asked,
Did I mention the Chiss?
To Leia's credit, she did not look away from the forward viewport, but she did lose her concentration. The fog came rolling back into the channel ahead of the Falcon, and Han lost sight of the spire. He jerked back on the throttles, then felt a sudden stab of neck pain as something slammed the ship forward.
What was that?
Nor asked from behind him.
Did we crash?
Something hit us from behind, Han replied. The mapping skiff? Leia asked. It was following us, Han said.
I hate that.
Oh, dear. I hope there aren't any casualties.
It would serve them right, Han growled, then returned to his comm mic. Okay, kid. Tell us about the Chiss. It's not as bad as it sounds.
Kip told them about Aristokra Sweck's visit and Kyle Omis' suggestion that Luke handle the matter personally, and then said,
Master Skywalker knew you'd be worried, so he asked Silgul to fill you in when you asked for the Maltorian dossier. I really wasn't...
The Falcon shuddered. Cockmame, Leia's Nogri bodyguard, reported that, despite its damage, the mapping skiff was firing at them.
Then shoot back, Han ordered. Kip, you'll have to...
Standing by,
Kip acknowledged.
Be careful.
I've got a better idea. Han pushed the throttles forward and accelerated into the fog, then asked Leia, Can you do that fog thing again?
Yes, Leia said.
But why not climb out of here and fight where we can see? Han allowed himself a sly grin.
Didn't you see that spire up ahead?
I saw it, Leia said. A smile as sly as Han's came to her lips.
I like the way you think, flyboy.
How does he think?
Nor asked.
What are we doing?
You'll see, Han said. Just hold on.
Leia turned her attention back to the fog, and soon the verdant finger of a vine-covered spire could be seen jutting up at the end of the channel. If Han did not break until the last second, the mapping skiff following them would have no time to avoid a crash. Nor finally saw what they were planning.
No!
He shrieked the word with both mouths.
My people could never inhabit a planet won through murder.
Okay.
Han pulled the control yoke back and the Falcon began to climb free of Bo-Rao's clouds.
The world grabbers win again.
Sorry to hear that,
Kip said over the comm.
But you'll have a freer rein in the Maltorian belt. There are no gray areas with Three-Eye.
Not so fast, kid. We haven't said we're going.
But Jaina
is in the unknown regions, Han said. That's the point.
Kip, give us a second. Leia muted the comm mic, then asked, What are you thinking?
You know what I'm thinking, Han said. You're thinking the same thing.
I suppose I am. Leia sighed. You know there's no sense going after them.
Them? Han asked. Jaina and Loey and...
And Jason. Leia's eyes were closed. It feels like he's on the move, too.
Another reason to go, Han said.
5 years is too long. Leia reactivated the channel. Sorry, Kip, we can't help you, she said. Han and I have other plans.
The unknown object lay directly ahead of Jade Shadow, a crooked oval of darkness the size of a human thumb. Sensor reading suggested a body about as dense as ice,
which would have been a rare, though not impossible thing to find, floating around loose in the interstellar void. But infrared measurements placed the core temperature at somewhere between warm and sweltering, and the spectrograph showed a halo of escaped atmosphere that suggested living inhabitants. Mara had already sensed as much through the Force. She could feel a strange presence within the object, diffuse and ancient and utterly huge. There were also other more familiar life forms, smaller, distinct, and somehow enclosed within the haze of the larger being. But there was no hint of Jaina or the other strike team members, nor of the urgent summons they had reported from these coordinates. Mara glanced at an activation reticle in the front of the cockpit. A small section of the Shadow's plexalloy canopy opaqued into a mirror, and she turned her attention to Luke and Sava Sebatine, who were seated high behind her in the co-pilot's and navigator's chairs. "Time to reconnoiter?" she asked.
"What's recon... recoin... recoy?"
The question came from behind Luke's chair, where a freckle-faced boy with red hair and fiery blue eyes stood peering around the edge of the flight deck hatchway.
"What's that?"
"Reconnoiter, Ben. It means take a look." A smile came to Mara's heart at the sight of her son, but she forced a stern tone. "Aren't you supposed to be playing with Nana?"
"Nana's game module is for little kids," he complained. "She was trying to make me play Teeks and Ewoks."
"And why aren't you?" Luke asked.
"I turned her off."
"How?" Mara asked. "Her power switch is hidden under her neck armor." Ben looked away as casually as a young boy could.
"I tricked her into bending down and showing it to me."
"Promise me you won't do that again," Luke said. "Nana can't protect you if you shut her down."
"I promise."
"Good," Luke said. "Maybe you should go reactivate her."
"But we're there! I want to see Jaina."
"Jaina isn't here anymore," Mara said. "Now do as your father says." Mara hooked her thumb toward the main cabin. "Go power up Nana and stay with her until we figure out where Jaina is." Ben didn't argue, but neither did he turn to go.
"If Ben doesn't wish to go, this one will watch him."
Saba spun her chair around and winked a slit-pupiled eye at him.
"He can sit on her lap."
Eyes widening, Ben spun on his heel and disappeared down the access corridor. Saba sissed in amusement. Luke asked R2-D2 to bring up an infrared image of the unknown object. What looked like a collection of palpitating blood cells appeared on Mara's display screen. Each cell had an irregular white heart, surrounded by a pink halo, and they were all connected by a tangled web of flowing red dashes. Saba rose and turned to leave the flight deck.
"This one will take the Stealth X and reconnoiter."
"Better hold tight," Mara said. On the infrared display, a string of tiny white circles was flaring to life near the center of the unknown object. "At least until we know what those are." The circles began to swirl and grow larger. Mara didn't even try to count the number, but there had to be over 100 of them. She initiated a series of automated systems checks to warn the Shadow's battle circuits. "Lower." The Shadow's retractable laser cannons dropped into firing position as Luke anticipated Mara's order. She armed the proton torpedoes and opened the firing tube doors. "R2, tell Nana to put Ben in his crash couch," Luke ordered. "Nobody said they were shooting," Luke said. "We just want to be ready."
"Really?"
Luke responded.
"That many?"
Mara glanced at the corner of her display and saw a counter quickly adding numbers.
500?
She gasped. "Who sends 500 craft to investigate one intruder?" Mara checked her display, then asked, "What old blink code?"
"Imperial."
Mara looked at the side of the canopy. The swarm had drawn close enough now to reveal the sleek, dart-shaped hulls of a small fighter craft stretched between the green nose strobes and the yellow rocket tails.
In the closest vessel, she could barely make out a pair of curved antennae pressed against the interior of a low cockpit canopy, and there were two bulbous black eyes peering out at her. As in Palpatine's empire? Then tell us what they're saying, Luke ordered. The message appeared on Mara's display. Lysel welcomes you. Please, all arrivals, may please enter through the central portal, please. The nearer the Falcon drew to her destination, the more mystified Leia became. The thumb-sized oval of darkness they had found when they emerged from hyperspace, at the coordinates they had wheedled out of Corin Horn, who was supervising operations in Luke's absence, was now a wall of murk that stretched to all edges of the cockpit canopy. But the terrain scanners showed a jumble of asteroids, ice balls, and dustbergs ranging from 100 meters across to several thousand, all held together by a web of metal struts and stony tubes. Though the structure had not yet collapsed under its own gravity, a rough guess of its mass was enough to make Leia worry. The Falcon's escorts, a swarm of small dart ships being flown by something with antennae and big bulbous eyes, suddenly peeled off and dispersed into the surrounding darkness. A jagged array of lights came to life ahead, hooking along its length toward a single golden light at the end. That must be the guidance signal the dart ships told us to watch for, Leia said. Follow the amber light, and slow down. It could be dangerous in there. In where? Han asked. Leia sent a duplicate of the terrain schematic to the pilot's display. Han decelerated so hard that even the inertial compensators could not keep her from being pitched into her crash webbing. You sure about this? He asked. It looks about as safe as a rancor's throat down there. The image on their displays was that of a jagged 5-kilometer mouth surrounded by a broken rim of asteroids, with dark masses of dust and stone tumbling down into the opening in lazy slow motion. Though the scanner's view extended only 2,000 meters into the chasm, the part it did show was a twisted, narrowing shaft lined by craggy protrusions and dark voids. I'm sure. Leia could feel her brother's presence somewhere deep inside the jumble of asteroids, calm, cheerful, and curious. Luke knows we're here. He wants us to come in. As they passed over the array, Leia began to catch glimpses of a black, grainy surface carefully cleaned of the dark dust that usually lay meters thick on carbonaceous asteroids. Once, she thought she saw something scuttling across a circle of light, but Han was keeping them too far above the asteroid to be certain, and it would have been too dangerous to ask him to go in for a closer look. She trained a vidcam on the surface and tried to magnify the image, but the shaft was too dusty and dark for a clear picture. All she saw was a screen full of gray grains not too different from sensor static. They were barely past the first array when two more came to life, beckoning the Falcon deeper into the abyss. Han angled toward the array, shunting extra power to the particle shields. Han weaved past a dozen obstacles, working their way across the abyss toward the second array of lights. Han swung the Falcon in behind the lights and began a steep approach toward the surface. The array began to flash more brightly, illuminating the rough silvery surface of a metallic asteroid. On the ground behind the first beacon, Leia saw the swirling lines of a closed iris hatch, made from some tough membrane that bulged slightly outward under the pressure of the asteroid's internal atmosphere. The light itself was held aloft on the end of a conical, meter-long stand that seemed to be crawling across the surface of the asteroid on 6 stick-like legs.
Bugs! Han groaned and shook his head. Why did it have to be bugs?
Luke felt as though he had swallowed a jug of minnows. Ben had turned an alarming hue of green. Mara, who could normally whirl dance for hours in weak gravity, held her jaws clamped tight against the possibility of an embarrassing eruption. The Skywalkers were hardly micro-G novices, but their stomachs were rebelling at the utter strangeness of the asteroid colony, at the sticky gold wax that lined the corridors, at the constant thrum of insect sounds, at the endless parade of six-limbed, meter-high workers scurrying past on the walls and ceiling. Saba, however, seemed entirely comfortable. She was moving along in front, trotting along a wall on all fours, her head swinging from side to side and her long tongue licking the sweet air. They came to a cockeyed intersection, and Luke stopped to listen to a strange pulsing sound that was rumbling out of a crooked side tunnel. It was muted, eerie, and rasping, but there was a definite melody and rhythm. "Music," he said. "If you're from Tatooine, maybe," Mara said. "The rest of us would call that a rancor belch."
"This one likes it," Saba said. "It makes her tail shake."
"I've seen squeaky thrust impellers make your tail shake," Mara said. She pointed at the floor where a steady flow of booted feet had worn the wax down to the stone. "But it is popular. Let's check it out." They started up the passage, and Ben asked, "Is this where Jaina is?" "No," Luke said. "I told you she's not in the asteroid colony." "Then where is she?" "We don't know." Luke looked over his shoulder at Ben. "That's what we're trying to find out. But I do feel Aunt Leia. She's here with Uncle Han." As they continued up the passage, the music grew clearer. After about 50 meters, the passage opened into a cavernous, dimly lit chamber, filled with rough-looking spacers. The music came from a clear area in the center of the room, where a trio of stick-like verpine stood playing beneath the chemical glow of a dozen waxy shine balls.
"Astral!"
Ben left Mara's side and started into the cantina.
"This is gonna blast!"
Mara caught him by the shoulder. "Not a chance." Mara nodded Luke toward the cantina, then said to Ben, "You and I will stand watch out here." Luke and Saba stepped through the door. The usual assortment of riff-raff spacers, Given, Bothans, Nikto, Quarren, were gathered in the middle of the room, sitting on synthetic stone benches and holding their drinks in their laps. Luke followed Saba to the service area, where a distracted Duros stood at the end of a long bank of beverage dispensers. Luke and Saba studied the unmarked dispensers for a moment, then Saba hissed in frustration.
"Blood sour."
The Duro swung his noseless head around sharply.
"Don't have blood sour," he said in his flat Duro's voice. "Only ambrosia."
"Will this one like it?"
The Duros nodded.
"Everyone likes ambrosia."
"Then I'll have the same," Luke said. The Duros turned to the nearest dispenser and filled two mugs with a thick amber liquid. Luke pulled a 10-credit voucher from his pocket, but the Duros waved it off.
"Nobody pays here."
"Nobody pays?" Saba echoed. "This one doesn't believe you."
A hint of indignation permeated the force. Then the Duros shrugged and looked back to the verpine musicians. Saba studied him for a moment, then glanced at Luke.
"This one is tired. She will find a seat."
She took a sip from her mug, then started to work her way deeper into the cantina. The Duros looked as though he wished Luke would join her, but Luke remained where he was, pouring camaraderie and goodwill into the force. The Duros' aloofness did not melt until Saba raised a storm of angry jabbering by taking an empty seat in front of an Ewok.
"This should be interesting,"
the Duros grinned.
"That little Ewok has a death mark in 10 systems."
"You don't say." Luke took a sip of Membrosia. "Have you been here long?"
"Too long,"
the Duro said.
"Turns out Lysel doesn't use processing chips, and now I can't get a cargo out."
"Is that a common problem?"
"Common, but not a problem."
The Duros waved his hand vaguely in the direction of the Membrosia dispensers.
"Everything's free, and you can stay as long as you want."
"Very generous," Luke said. "What's the catch?"
"Isn't one,"
the Duros said.
"Except you get used to it and then you don't want to leave."
"That sounds like a catch to me," Luke said.
"Depends on how you look at it,"
the Duros admitted.
especially if you have obligations at home.
Why don't you just take your chips back to the known galaxy? Luke asked.
Too dangerous.
The Duros cocked his big head toward Luke.
Already had 5 Jedi come through on my tail. That's when I decided to dump the load.
You're sure the Jedi were looking for you?
Who else would they be looking for?
Luke stepped closer to the Duros and lowered his voice. Were the Jedi fairly young, a couple of humans with a bearable and a Wookiee?
And a Twi'lek.
The Duros' voice grew suspicious.
How'd you know?
I've got a little problem of my own with them, Luke said. And I don't want to find them waiting at my next stop. Know where they went?
Sorry,
the Duros said.
You need to ask Lysel.
Out of the corner of his eye, Luke saw that Saba was on her way over, a furry little Ewok at her side. It was the Ewok she had sat in front of earlier, with a single white stripe running diagonally across a stocky body that was otherwise as black as space. They stopped in front of Luke. Who's your friend?
Tarfang,
Saba replied.
He says he can help us find our friends.
Save for the lining of golden wax, the rows of shine balls stuck to the ceiling, the random tunnel openings, and the lack of even a vague sense of up or down, the interior of the spherical hangar resembled all the spaceports Han Solo had visited on 1,000 unknown, out-of-the-way planets scattered across the galaxy. There was the usual collection of battered transports, the usual cargo of stolen goods on open display, the usual dregs of their species smugglers bustling in and out of their vessels, working harder to make dishonest livings than they would have at honest jobs. Han eyed the giant bugs that seemed to be crawling across every surface. The more Han watched the activity around the transports, the more he felt his skin crawl. The bugs were marching in and out of the vessels completely unescorted, offloading cargo, foodstuffs, even vital ship's tools, and stacking them at the base of the boarding ramps. Han spied the sleek gray wedge of a Horizon-class space yacht resting about halfway up the wall of the docking vault. Its landing struts sunk well past their feet in the waxy substance that coated the chamber. The boarding ramp was lowered, and a big Tendrando Arms Defender droid was standing beside it, her massive torso and systems-packed limbs at odds with her cherubic face and smiling mouth. "There's the shadow," Han said. He brought the Falcon's nose around and started toward an open berthing space on the wall next to Mara's ship. "Let's go say hello." Leia shook her head. "It doesn't feel like there's anyone aboard."
No?
Han scowled.
Probably in the cantina already.
Han swung the Falcon's stern up along the wall and landed in the open berth. Han rose and strapped on his blaster.
Okay, let's go see Nana. Maybe she can fill us in.
They lowered the boarding ramp and reeled back as a wave of warm, too sweet air rolled through the hatchway. The vault was filled with a blaring cacophony of ticking that immediately sent a rivulet of sweat rolling down Han's spine. Half a dozen bugs appeared at the bottom of the ramp and started to board. They had deep orange thoraxes, pale blue abdomens, and feathery meter-long antennae. Han's stomach turned queasy, but he started down to meet them. Han stopped midway down the ramp. He folded his arms across his chest and assumed a stance wide enough to block the ramp, then forced himself to glare down at the lead bug.
"Where do you fellows think you're going?"
The lead bug stared up, ticking its mandibles nervously, and emitted a soft drumming from its chest. It dropped to all sixes, lowering itself to about knee height, then dipped its antennae politely and shot between Han's legs.
"Hey!"
Before the bug could continue up the ramp, Han spun around and caught it by the undersized wings on its back.
"Hold on!"
The bug spun its head around to meet Han's gaze, then pointed at his hands and gently clacked its mandibles.
Captain Solo?
C-3PO said helpfully.
I do believe the insect is requesting that you release it.
You understand this stuff?
Han asked.
I'm afraid it's only an educated guess.
Then not a chance.
Han, Leia said, I don't sense any danger here. Until C-3PO figures out how to communicate...
I am communicating.
Han fixed his gaze on the nearest of its eyes and said,
I don't know who you think I am, but no one boards the Falcon until I say so.
The other five bugs dropped to all sixes, then slipped to the underside of the ramp and continued toward the hatchway.
No!
Han flipped the insect he was holding off the ramp, then started after the others.
Stop them!
The two Nogri bodyguards stepped in front of Leia and placed themselves squarely in the door, crouched for action. The bugs swung back to the ramp's upper side and tried to squeeze aboard the Falcon anyway. The first pair were knocked away by a pair of quick Nogri kicks. The remaining trio of insects stopped where they were and dropped into a six-limbed crouch. Their antennae fell flat against their heads, and a soft little began to come from their chests. BD-8, the Solo's battle droid, appeared behind the Nogri and pointed his blaster cannon over Miwal's shoulder.
Intruders identified. Permission to fire?
No! Leia snapped. Stand down! Return to Leisure Station.
Leisure Station?
BD-8's tone grew doubtful as the other bugs continued up the ramp.
Ma'am, we're being boarded.
We're not being boarded, Leia said.
Not if I can help it, Han said.
He snatched another of the bugs and in the low gravity sent it spinning 20 meters across the hangar. A bitter odor began to waft up from the floor. Han looked down to see two of the dislodged bugs standing beside the ramp on their four front limbs, their abdomens raised so they could squirt greenish fluid on the sides of the ramp.
What the garzel?
Han cried. The bugs drummed.
Captain Solo, we seem to have another visitor.
The droid pointed past Han's shoulder. Han turned around to find a tall, bald-headed figure with large, buggy eyes and a pair of thick tusks approaching the Falcon's boarding ramp. In his hand, he carried a rag and a spray canister.
Great, Han said. Now an Aqualish.
That can't be good, Leia said. What's he want?
To wash the viewports, it looks like, Han said. What do you want, Fangface?
Nothing, friend.
The Aqualish spoke in the gravelly voice typical of his species.
Just to help you out.
Han and Leia exchanged puzzled glances.
We're not your friends, Han said.
You will be.
The Aqualish waited until the bugs finished squirting, then shooed away the one on his side of the ramp and sprayed a harsh-smelling foam over the same area.
That stuff better not be corrosive, Han warned.
It's not.
He tossed the spray canister to Han.
You need to clean that mess up.
The Aqualish pointed at the far side of the ramp where the other worker had squirted its goo, then started to wipe the area he had already coated. Han sprayed a thick layer of foam over the side of the ramp.
Tell me again what I'm doing.
When you tossed the workers off, they marked you,
the Aqualish explained. He tossed Han the rag.
Now you have to start over, or they'll call their soldiers and tear your ship apart to see what you're hiding.
Start over? Leia asked.
Transacting,
the Aqualish explained.
Isn't that why you're here?
Maybe,
Han said. You mean like trading, right?
More like taking,
the Aqualish said.
They take what they want, you take what you want. Everybody's happy.
The insect started up the ramp again.
They're not gonna lay eggs or anything?
Han asked.
No, they only do that in the heart comb, the Aqualish assured him. Just let them bring out whatever they want, then take back whatever you want to keep. It's a lot easier and safer.
If you say so.
Han stepped aside to let the bugs pass. Okay? The lead worker responded with a single mandible clack, which was simultaneously echoed by the rest of the squad.
That would be an affirmative,
C-3PO offered helpfully. The bugs started up the ramp. Han jumped down beside the Aqualish and returned the spray canister and rag. He reached for his money.
What do I owe you for the help?
Nothing, friend.
The Aqualish waved a dismissing hand.
It happens to everyone the first time.
Really?
Han's mind began searching for angles, trying to figure out what kind of swindle the Aqualish was trying to pull.
Hope you don't mind me saying so, but you're a pretty helpful guy for your kind.
The Aqualish watched the last bug disappear into the Falcon, then nodded.
Yeah, I don't get it either.
He turned and started back toward his own vessel.
This place just makes me feel good.
Han, Leia, and the others spent the next hour returning to the Falcon most of what the bugs carried off. At first, the work was confusing and frustrating, especially after they had carried the same crate of protein packages aboard for the 7th or 8th time. But eventually, order emerged, with the ship's crew leaving anything they could bear to part with at the foot of the ramp and stacking whatever they wanted to keep in the forward hold. Finally, the only item under contention was Killick Twilight, a small moss painting they had once hung outside Leia's bedroom in House Organa on Alderaan. Designed by the late Ob Kador, one of Alderaan's foremost artists, the piece depicted a line of enigmatic insectoid figures departing their pinnacle city home with a fierce storm sweeping in behind them. Han had no idea why the bugs were so taken with it, apart from the subject matter, but every time he put it on the keepstack, an insect would deposit a jug of spirits or a shine ball in its place and carry it back down the ramp again. A bug emerged from the Falcon, carrying Killick Twilight in its forearms, and stopped about halfway down the ramp, peering over the top of the frame. Han, waiting at the bottom, folded his arms and sighed.
Come on, he said. Let's get it over with.
Instead of continuing down the ramp, the worker jumped to the floor and disappeared behind the disordered heap of crates and spare tools stacked next to the Falcon.
Hey!
Han rushed to the other side to cut off the bug's escape, but it was nowhere to be seen.
Blast!
Han slowly turned, his pulse pounding as he searched for the bug. Halfway up the hangar wall, he saw the Skywalkers emerging from a passage with Saba Sebatine and a black-furred Ewok, but no sign of the thief.
Hot slime!
Han? Leia appeared at the top of the boarding ramp.
What's wrong?
Nothing,
Han answered. A soft rustle sounded from the transaction pile. Han peered over a stack of raw protein packages and saw a slender insect foot sliding behind a crate of Endorian brandy.
I've got everything under control.
Han slipped around the stack of packages, then pulled the crate aside and found the worker bug cowering with Killick Twilight in its four hands. It thrummed.
Yeah? Two can play that game.
Han pulled the painting from its grasp, then turned to find Ben rushing up ahead of Luke and the others.
Uncle Han! Dad said you were here!
Good to see you, kid.
Han touched his elbow to Ben's.
I'd love to talk, but I'm in the middle of a contest of wills.
Leaving Leia to slow down the bug and greet Luke and the others, Han carried the painting onto the Falcon, then knelt on the floor and opened a smuggling compartment.
That's a funny place to put Aunt Leia's painting, said Ben, who had followed him aboard.
Tell me about it,
Han said. He slipped the painting into the compartment, closed the cover, and stood.
Now let's go see your mom and...
The bug appeared in the corridor, sweeping its antennae along the floor. It passed Han with a polite rumble, then stopped, and began to pry at the secret panel. When the compartment would not open, it sat down and began to clack its mandibles.
All right! You don't have to call your buddies!
Han opened the panel. The insect pulled the painting from the compartment and turned to leave, then let out a startled rumble when it found Saba and her Ewok companion coming up the corridor. The Ewok snatched the painting from the bug's hands, turned it over, and spat on the back.
What the blazes?
Han turned to Saba. Is this guy a friend of yours?
Tarfang and I have made no kills together, Saba said. But he can help us.
Yeah?
Han watched doubtfully as Tarfang placed the painting on the floor. How? The Ewok glared up at Han and jabbered something in the squeaky language of his species, then motioned Han and the others toward the boarding ramp.
Listen up, Cuddles, Han said. I don't know who you think you are, but on the Falcon...
Uncle Han, look!
Ben pointed at Killick Twilight. The bug stood holding the painting in its hands, running its antennae over the back where the Ewok had spit. It repeated the gesture several times, then emitted a sad little hum and returned the painting to the smuggling compartment. Han looked back at Tarfang.
How'd you do that?
The Ewok's only answer was an indignant snort. He spun around and started for the boarding ramp. Touchy little fellow, isn't he?
Tarfang is not a nice being.
Saba started after the Ewok.
But his captain can help us find Jaina and the others.
Han caught up to her outside, where C-3PO informed them that Luke had gone on ahead with Tarfang. Despite Saba's assurances that Killick Twilight was perfectly safe now that someone had spit on it, Han asked the Nogri to stay with the painting. They dropped Ben at the shadow with Nana, then joined Luke, Mara, and Leia outside the blast-pocked carbon-scored disc of a small YT-1000 transport. They exchanged greetings all around, then climbed the boarding ramp into a surprisingly tidy airlock with all proper emergency equipment neatly stowed in a transparasteel rescue locker. Beyond the hatch, the interior of the main access corridor was lit only by two of the waxy shine balls the bugs used for illumination. By the green glow, Han could see that the Durasteel floor panels had been sanibuffed a little too well. There was a telltale shadow where the invisible seams came together over the smuggling compartments. Tarfang was waiting a few steps up the corridor. He grunted and waved them into the main cabin. Kneeling in front of an open engineering panel was a little jug-eared Celestin in a set of carbon-smeared utilities. Tarfang went to the Celestin's side and, coming to attention, cleared his throat.
Go on,
the Celestin spoke without looking away from his work.
I'm listening.
Tarfang launched into a lengthy explanation, gesturing at Saba and Luke, even though the Celestin's attention remained fixed on the control board. Finally, the captain finished the attachment he was working on and turned to his visitors.
I'm Jai Jun, captain of the XR-808G. Tarfang tells me you're looking for someone to help you catch your friends.
To find them, Luke corrected.
I see. Well, it makes no difference.
June cast an annoyed glance in Tarfang's direction.
I'm afraid my first mate sometimes exceeds his authority.
Tarfang asked something in a disbelieving tone.
It's not the mate's responsibility to raise funds, June replied. You let me worry how we're going to pay for that vortex stabilizer.
A warp vortex stabilizer?
Han asked, staying hidden in the shadows.
For a YT this old? It can't be easy to come by one of those out here.
Not at a fair...
June agreed.
I've had one brought in, but I'm 200 credits short of the shipping fees.
Not if you help us, you're not, Han said, stepping into the light. We can pay you the 200 credits.
June's mouth fell.
I knew that was your voice.
He turned to Tarfang.
Why didn't you tell me Han Solo was with them?
Tarfang sneered in Han's direction and prattled an answer.
Yan!
Yes, but this is Han Solo!
The Celestin rose and thrust a hand out.
The XR-808G follows all your procedures, and I've memorized all your combat maneuvers from the history vids.
I wouldn't trust everything I see in those holo vids, Han said, allowing the Celestin to shake his hand. Now about that help.
I'd like to help you,
June's voice grew disappointed. But it wouldn't be proper.
Proper? Han echoed. Why not?
Because I have an arrangement with our hosts, and evidently they don't want you to find your friends.
Tarfang groaned and slapped his brow.
We can't ignore the wishes of our business partners, June said to the Ewok. We have a deal.
A deal you can't keep until you find 200 credits, Han said. How long are they willing to wait?
We are facing a bit of a dilemma, June admitted.
What if we were to buy a copy of your charts? Luke asked. June shook his head.
My charts wouldn't help you. Your friends went to Yogoy.
And you don't know where Yogoy is? Luke asked.
Nobody does, June said. The Yogoy are very proud and secretive. They hide the location of their nest from outsiders.
Saba glared down at Tarfang.
Then why did you say you could help us find our friends?
Tarfang jabbered an answer.
Because the XR-808G has been assigned a cargo for Yogoy.
C-3PO translated.
And when a ship is assigned a cargo for Yogoy, it is also assigned a Yogoy to serve as its navigator for the trip.
Fine, Leia said. Help us get a cargo, and we'll pay you for consulting. Tarfang rattled off a long response, which C-3PO translated as...
Tarfang suggests you simply give Captain June the money. They'll check on our friends and give us a report when they return.
Sure they will. Han turned to the others. We're wasting our time here. Luke motioned Han to wait, his gaze fixed on Tarfang. Han realized for the first time that Mara was no longer with them. Under circumstances like these, she had an uncanny knack for slipping away unnoticed. Finally, Luke turned back to Han. Tarfang's not trying to swindle us, Han. He really does want to work out an honest deal.
No.
Tarfang snarled something at the Jedi Master.
He wasn't stealing your thoughts,
C-3PO said to the Ewok.
Master Luke is not a thief.
Tarfang whirled on the droid and yapped a command.
Mafita!
Very well. But I wouldn't blame him if he used his lightsaber on you.
C-3PO turned to Luke.
Tarfang is threatening to remove your eyes if you do that again.
Oh, that scares him, Han said to the Ewok. You want to make a deal? Here it is. 200 credits to get us a cargo. To Han's surprise, it was Saba who answered.
He can't.
Why not?
Because Lysel wouldn't allow it, Luke said. He or she doesn't want us to find Jaina and the others.
They, June corrected. Luke frowned. What?
They, June said. Lysel isn't their leader. Lysel is them.
They all share one name? Leia asked.
In a sense, but it's more than that. The way they think of it, they're all Lysel together. Lysel is the nest, but so are all of the members.
They don't have an individual sense of identity? Leia asked.
I think that's so, June said. But I'm not really current on my xenobiological definitions.
Tarfang chortled something helpful sounding. Master Tarfang says that it's only important to remember that when you say Lysel, you might be talking about the entire nest or any of its members.
Cozy, Han said. So why doesn't Lysel want us to find Jaina?
You have seen the joiners?
You mean Lysel's translators?
Not translators, June said. Joiners. They're Lysel too.
Saba lowered her scaly brow.
How can that be? Most of them do not even have six limbs. It doesn't matter, June said. They've been absorbed.
Absorbed? Han asked. Absorbed how?
Mentally, I suspect, Luke said. Is it some sort of brainwashing? June shrugged.
All I know is that when someone spends too long in a nest, he gets absorbed.
You're saying that my daughter thinks she's some kind of bug? Han demanded, taking a step forward. And you weren't going to tell me? June jumped up and stepped behind Leia.
It's not my fault.
Take it easy, Han, Luke said. We don't know that that has happened.
Do we know it hasn't?
Han countered. What does Lysel need with a group of Jedi Knights? Leia asked.
I don't know, June said. But they left with Yunu.
Yunu?
The Central Nest, June said.
Your daughter and the others were met by an escort of Yunu guards.
Then there's an organization of nests? Leia asked June. The Sullustan nodded.
The colony?
Han thought he was beginning to understand. How big? June pulled the data pad from beneath his utilities, then began punching keys.
I have heard 375 names.
Luke whistled. Enough to stretch from here to the Chiss frontier. Now this is beginning to make some sense.
How do you figure? Han asked.
The situation isn't complicated, Leia said. The colony is rubbing borders with the Chiss Empire. It's pretty clear why the Central Nest might want a team of Jedi joiners on their side, especially this particular team.
Jedi commandos are good equalizers, Han agreed. But what I want to know is how the colony got them to come out here in the first place.
Several moments passed with no answer, and finally their gazes began to drift toward June. Tarfang's eyes darted from one to the other of them, and finally he jabbered in angry denial.
Tarfang asks that you stop looking at them. He denies any involvement.
That's not what we were implying, Leia said. But we do need your help, Luke said to June. Han needs your help. We must find our Jedi Knights. June considered this for a moment, then said,
Perhaps there is a way. There's room in the forward hold if we hide you in there.
Forget it, Han said. We're flying our own ships.
I'm sure we can think of a way to follow Captain June. Luke spoke in a tone that suggested he had already solved this problem. We may need to install a couple of pieces of equipment. Tarfang raised a lip, then jabbered a demand.
What kind of equipment?
C-3PO translated. The secret kind, Luke said, glaring at the Ewok. The wreck was a CEC-YV-888 stock light freighter. Jason could see that much from its tall hull, and from the stubs of the melted maneuvering fins on the rear engine compartment. The crash had occurred sometime within the last decade. Jason waited for a throng of thumb-sized insects to scurry past on the enclosure wall, then placed a hand on top and vaulted over. A harsh rattle rose behind him as other larger visitors pulsed their wings in disapproval. He paid no attention and started up the slope, feeling his way with the force to avoid stepping on any tiny beings hidden in the flora. Jason's guide, a chest-high insect who had been waiting at the Lysel nest to serve as his navigator, scurried to his side and began to rumble objections.
You're the one who said we didn't have time to wait in line, Jason reminded him.
The guide responded.
I told you, Jason answered. I might know this ship.
Jason reached the crash crater and climbed to the rim. 10 meters below, in the crash bottom, a sagging tangle of heat-softened durasteel, so covered in crawling insects that it took a moment to realize he was looking at a small starship bridge. The vessel had crashed upside down. The guide thrummed impatiently. Not yet. Jason pointed at a place near the bow where a dozen Jawa-sized insects were sticking their antennae through a twisted rip in the hull. Ask the ones near that breach to clear a space. I need to see if I can read its name. The guide curled its antennae forward. Maybe, Jason said uncertainly. He was relying on the Force and his empathic connection with other life forms to infer his guide's meaning, and he could not always be sure that he understood all the nuances. The guide clacked its mandibles in frustration. It drummed its chest loudly. Then a space began to clear where Jason had requested. The Durasteel was so caked with carbonization that he could barely make out a handful of dark upside-down letters. Something A-C-H something O-N space F something E-R. Tachyon flyer, Jason said. It was the ship in which the strike team had planned to depart the Merkur system, until they were betrayed by two dark Jedi they had rescued from the Yuuzhan Vong. Seeing no easier way down, Jason stepped off the rim and used the Force to slow his descent. The insects on his side of the flyer watched in stunned silence as he caught hold of the rib in the hull and brought his fall to a gentle stop. Jason pulled himself up and peered through the hull breach. The flyer's presence certainly lay at the heart of the mysterious summons that had brought him here, but that told him little. Before he allowed himself to be drawn farther along this current, he needed to find out what had happened aboard the ship. He needed to know who had called the strike team survivors here and why. The interior of the vessel was dark and acrid-smelling, lit only by the shafts of light pouring through several dozen hull breaches. As his eyes grew attuned to the dim light, Jason realized that he was looking into the hold area. Jason slid down the hull, calling on the Force to hold himself against the wall and slow his descent. About two-thirds of the way to the bottom, he came to the jumble of decks and stopped, then used a Dathomiri Force spell to kindle a sphere of bright light. Floating his sphere of Force light behind him, Jason threaded his way down to what had been the underside of the bridge, where the metal was buckled and discolored from a conflagration below. Jason began to fear the worst. Seeing no convenient hatch in the vicinity, he ignited his lightsaber, then plunged it into the floor of the bridge. Jason finished cutting, then used the Force to lift two discs of metal out of the hole he had cut in the double-floored deck. Being careful to avoid touching the white-hot edges, Jason dropped through the hole and found several shattered Trancarest vials under one of the half-burned mattresses. Under another, he found a melted lump of casing and circuitry that might once have been Lobaka's translation droid, MTD. He tried to pick it up and discovered it had been fused to the floor. Under a third mattress, he found the singed remains of one of the Molotech jumpsuits the strike team had worn on their mission to Merkur. There were four slashes across the chest, where Raynar had been wounded before being put aboard the flyer. Jason made his way forward through the galley and wardroom, dropping into a crouch as the space between the crumpled ceiling and the old floor grew too short for him to walk upright. The walls and other surfaces in these rooms were covered with a thick layer of pink powder, the residue of a firefighting foam. On the bridge, the foam lay so thick that he kicked up clouds of pink dust as he moved. The canopy that had once enclosed the flight deck on three sides was buckled and broken, with dirt spilling through long rents in the transparasteel. It was no wonder the ship had crashed. The dark Jedi crew had done well to escape the Merkur system at all. Jason dropped to his knees to peer through the cockeyed hatchway, and his nostrils filled with the caustic stench of charred bone. He began a slow breathing exercise. The harsh smell burned his nostrils at first and threatened to make him nauseous. But as Jason centered himself in the Force and slowly detached from his emotions, the odor grew less biting, its implications less painful. He placed a hand on the wall and imagined it growing warm under his touch. The staleness seemed to fade from the air inside the wreck. Then the smell of old soot turned to the acrid bite of smoke. Jason's eyes started to water as he looked back through the Force. His lungs were racked by an endless fit of coughing, and the cabin grew hot and orange. Where he was touching the wall, his palm began to sting and blister. He held it in place and looked over his shoulder. The flight deck was hidden behind a curtain of smoke and rolling flame. Geysers of fire retardant rose from the ceiling nozzles, creating swirling ghosts of pink fog. Howls of human anguish drowned out the scream of buckling metal. A single figure crawled out of the smoke, hairless and coughing and blistered raw. His face was unrecognizable, but four gashes ran diagonally across his chest, the wound hanging half open where the flesh glue had dissolved in the heat. One hand trailed behind, dragging a pair of levitated shapes along by their cloak collars. The two shapes were still burning, writhing in the air and flailing against each other in their pain. Smoke began to rise from beneath Jason's palm, and the smell of cooking flesh filled the air. He kept his hand pressed against the wall. The crawling figure reached the hatchway and paused, turning in Jason's direction. The face was too scorched and swollen to recognize, but the eyes belonged to Raynar, questioning and proud and so terribly naive. The two of them locked gazes for a moment. Then Raynar cocked his head in confusion and started to open his mouth. Jason pulled his hand from the wall. The figures vanished instantly, returning him to a flight deck filled with the stale smell of ash and clouds of pink dust. Jason removed a small canister from his equipment belt and sprayed a coating of synth flesh over his palm. Raynar had been the misfit of their childhood group, trying a little too hard to fit in and often the butt of jokes for his arrogance and showy clothes. He had never impressed anyone as exceptional Jedi material, and there had been a few conversations in which fellow candidates had expressed reservations about his judgment and initiative. Yet what Raynar had done on the flyer, risking his own life to save those who had betrayed his friends and abducted him, was the essence of being a Jedi Knight. Floating his force light ahead of him, Jason crawled into the engineering cabin and followed Raynar's trail through a cramped maze of toppled equipment. The stench of charred bones grew stronger, and Jason feared he would only find their burned remains trapped in some dead-end corner, or simply lying in the middle of the aisle where Raynar had succumbed to smoke inhalation. His fears began to seem justified when he started to find scorched bones in the middle of the aisle. First, a few finger and toe and hand bones, then a forearm and a shin, then finally a femur. The space between the floor and ceiling grew smaller and smaller, and he had to drop to his belly, and he began to sense the residue of Raynar's panic in the Force. Then Jason came to the shoulder blade, lying half buried in a pile of dirt that had poured in through a rent in the hull, and he knew. He began to dig, pulling the soft dirt under his body and pushing it back with his feet, and a moment later, he felt a welcome draft of fresh air. Raynar had reached an exit, but in what condition? Had he survived? Had either of the others? His chest tight with hope and fear, Jason belly crawled through the hole, out into the bottom of the crater, and was surprised to find his guide waiting. In its hands, the insect held a new starfighter helmet and flight suit. Without waiting for Jason to stand, the guide offered the helmet and suit to him. Jason stood. Why would I need a starfighter helmet? Instead of taking either item, he began to brush himself off. I fly a skiff. The guide raised one of its four hands toward the crater rim, where one of the Reconstruction Police's new XJ-5 X-Wings sat with an open cockpit. The guide thrummed a long explanation, which seemed to assert that he would be much happier serving the colony in a Chasex than his skiff, which the colony was already using to ferry a group of Togot pilgrims back to the spaceport. "Why would I want to serve the colony?" Jason asked. "If the colony expects me to kill people, you'd better be able to tell me why." Jason looked up at the crater rim and was puzzled to find an image of his mother there, frowning across the gap at the flyer's blast-pocked hull. She turned to someone he could not see, then asked, "What happened to the crew?" There was a pause while she listened to the reply. His mother looked back to the flyer. "I mean the rest of the crew. We know Raynar survived." Jason had his answer, but he was not ready to release the vision. Not yet. He looked up at his mother's image, reaching out to her in the Force to strengthen their contact. "Hello." Her gaze dropped toward Jason's voice. Then she furrowed her brow and reached out as though grasping for someone's arm. "Jason has been here." "Has." So they were still behind him. The guide snapped its mandibles next to Jason's ear. No one. Sorry. Continuing to hold the vision through the forest, Jason finally took the helmet and flight suit. Okay. Where am I going? The guide replied that Jason wouldn't recognize the name of the system. It was on the Chiss frontier. Humor me. In case something happens and I need to find my own way. The navigator spread its antennae. It answered. Jason? His mother's face grew pale. How? You're not. I'm fine, Mom, he said. I'll see you soon. Koribu, in the Gyul system. As the Falcon dropped toward the mottled pinnacles below, Leia found herself straining against her crash webbing, almost gasping at the bustling vastness of the colony's central nest. The Yogoi towers, brightly adorned in wild splashes of color, stood hip to hip across the entire planet, and the air was so thick with flying vehicles that she could barely see the surface. Kind of looks like old Coruscant, Han said, speaking to Leia and over the comm to Luke, Mara, and everyone else aboard the Shadow. So big, and all that bustle. Leia continued to strain forward over her controls, peering out the lower edge of the canopy. As the Falcon descended, she began to see that while the pinnacles came in every size, they were all distinctly cone-shaped, and they all had horizontally banded exteriors, like the insect spires in Killick Twilight. They followed the XR-808G down to within 100 meters of ground level, where the balloon bikes and airspeeders gave way to rivers of racing land speeders, speeder bikes, and dangerous-looking rocket carts steered exclusively by Yogoi pilots. June began to fly erratically, making last-second turns and doubling back on his own trail. If not for the tracking blip, Leia would have lost him a dozen times in half an hour. Finally, they swung onto a large curving boulevard and began to circle a massive complex of fused towers sheathed in an eye-pulling mosaic done in every imaginable shade of red. The XR-808G eased steadily toward the interior lanes, then abruptly dropped to ground level and disappeared into the dark mouth of a huge barrel-vaulted gateway. Han eased the yoke forward and swung the Falcon into the murky gateway. Leia activated the forward maneuvering lights, illuminating the interior of a huge winding passage covered in a wavy pink and yellow mosaic. After a couple of minutes, they emerged in a small flower-shaped plaza enclosed by a dozen fused towers. At the far side of the area, the XR-808G sat on its landing struts, its boarding ramp already dropping into position. Han brought the Falcon to within 20 meters and set her down with the missile launchers facing the XR-808G. Cockmame, Miwal, be ready with those cannons, he ordered over the intercom. Ready?
Prepare to open fire, Captain,
the droid reported. Not yet, Leia said. Only if they shoot first. Han led the way up the flight deck, and they descended the boarding ramp to find June scurrying toward them in a torn tunic.
Han! Princess Leia! He called cheerfully.
BD-8 came up behind Leia and glared over her shoulder, clicking and whirring loudly. June stopped 3 meters away and gawked up at the battle droid. Leia glimpsed movement on the tower walls behind him, then saw several tiers of insect soldiers stepping into view. They looked much like Lysol workers, except they were the size of a Wookiee, with meter-long mandibles and scarlet carapaces covering their backs. The undersides of their thoraxes were bright gold, and their eyes were a deep, haunting purple. In their four hands, they each carried a crude electrobolt assault rifle and a short, thick-shafted trident. The three lowest rows of soldiers raised their carapaces, then stepped off their terraces and added to the tumult the roar of hundreds of beating wings. June scurried over to join them, his round ears red with alarm. The soldiers continued to swirl overhead in a dark mass for several seconds, then glided to the plaza floor and formed a tightly packed cordon around the Falcon and XR-808G.
Situation critical,
BD-8 reported.
Permission to return to stand ready?
Granted, Leia said. The soldiers thrummed their chests in a single deafening boom, then brought their feet together and snapped their weapons to the attention position against their thoraxes. On the far side of the XR-808G, the cordon parted to admit a small parade of insects of many different body shapes, ranging in size from that of Leia's thumb to somewhat larger than an X-wing. Most seemed to be simple variations on the standard colony pattern, with feathery antennae, large bulbous eyes, and four arms and two legs. In the center of the procession walked an imposing, melt-faced man with no ears or hair and a mere bulge for a nose. His brows had fused into a single knobby ridge, and all his visible skin had the shiny, stiff quality of a burn scar. He wore purple trousers with a scarlet cape over a gold chitin breastplate.
"Who's the fashion victim?"
Han asked June.
"I think it's the Prime Yunu."
June's voice was almost a gasp.
"Nobody ever sees him."
"The Prime Yunu?" Leia asked.
"You might consider him the chief of the colony,"
June whispered. The Prime Yunu stopped in front of the XR-808G, and two of his companions boarded the battered freighter. Leia reached out in the Force, trying to gauge his intentions, and found the same double presence she had come to recognize in the joiners of the Lysol Nest. She looked up and found him staring in her direction, his blue eyes shining like a pair of oncoming blaster bolts. Leia raised her chin and held his gaze. Her vision grew dark around the edges, and soon she could see nothing but his eyes. He winked and looked away, and Leia felt herself falling.
"Whoa!"
Han caught her under her arms.
"What's wrong?"
"Nothing." Leia allowed Han to hold her as her vision returned to normal. "The king is force-sensitive." The Prime raised two fingers and pointed at the Falcon's laser cannons. There was a thunk as the turrets broke their collar locks, then the muffled scream of grating servo motors.
"Hey!"
Han protested. The turrets continued to rotate, tearing up their internal maneuvering mechanisms until the cannons faced aft.
"Hostile action underway,"
BD-8 reported.
"Permission to..."
The Prime raised a finger toward him, and the request ended in a garbled blast of static. The harsh smell of melting circuits filled the air, then the droid crashed to the ground. The ghastly figure crossed the last few steps and stopped in front of the Solos, towering over Han by a good third of a meter. For a moment, he stood glaring down, his breath coming in audible wheezes that suggested badly damaged lungs, his blue eyes sliding back and forth between their faces.
"Captain Solo."
His voice was a deep, gravelly rasp that made Leia's throat close with empathic pain.
"Princess Leia, we weren't expecting you."
Leia's mind flashed back to the Yavin 4 visit, to a handsome blonde-haired boy lying unconscious on the floor after being bitten by Jason's crystal snake. A handsome boy dressed in the haughty scarlet golden purple of the Bornaran shipping empire.
"Raynar?" she gasped. "Raynar Thule?"
"Raynar Thule is no more,"
Raynar said. He was squatting on his haunches in the heart of the Prime Chamber, high atop a circular dais where he would always be visible to the hundreds of insect attendants that followed wherever he went.
"We are Yunu Thule."
"How strange, then, that I still sense Raynar Thule's presence within yours," Luke said. "Raynar Thule may be in hiding, but he is not gone. I feel that clearly."
"We are surprised, Master Skywalker, that you cannot feel the difference between a ghost and a man. Raynar Thule vanished with the crash."
"And then Yunu Thule was born?"
"The kind are not born, Master Skywalker," an egg drops. A chrysalis is spun.
You mean there was a metamorphosis? Leia asked. Along with Mara and Saba, she was sitting cross-legged with Luke on the dais floor. Han, of course, could not be talked into sitting. He was pacing the edge of the dais, keeping a wary eye on the attendants below and grumbling about the heat and mugginess and too sweet smell of the nest. Is that the story on the walls? Leia gestured at the colorful mosaics that decorated the interior of the prime chamber.
You are as observant as we recall, princess,
Raynar said.
Others are not usually observant enough to perceive the Chronicle.
The Chronicle? Luke asked. Raynar pointed over Luke's shoulder, where a red streak arced down the dome ceiling to a white smear opposite the main entrance to the chamber.
A star wagon fell from the sky.
As Luke twisted around to look, he glimpsed the blocky hull of an overturned YV-888 light freighter, protruding above the rim of a still-smoking crater. Luke let his gaze slide to the next image and glimpsed Raynar kneeling over a wounded insect, his palms pressed to its cracked thorax.
No, Master Skywalker. Over there.
Raynar pointed to a pinkish blotch on the adjacent wall.
The kind do not order such things in the same way you others do.
When Luke turned his head, he saw a scorched figure lying in the bottom of the crash crater, surrounded by waiting insects.
Beside the star wagon, Yogoi found Raynar Thul, a scorched and dying thing. We climbed down to wait for the last note, so we could share his flesh among our larvae.
Raynar pointed across the room again, to another mosaic depicting the insects carrying him toward a small enclave of spires similar to those in the city outside.
But he touched us inside, and we were filled with the need to care for his body.
The next image showed Raynar's burned body in the bottom of a large six-sided basin, curled into a fetal position and tended by two human-sized insects.
We built a special cell, and we fed him and cleaned him like our own larvae.
Luke had to slide his glance past the following scene three times before he could be sure of what he was seeing. The mosaic showed only Raynar's face, surrounded by the walls of a much smaller cell, his neck craned back and his mouth gaping open to accept a meal from a nearby insect.
After a time, Raynar Thul was no more.
The picture he pointed to next showed Raynar rising from the cell much as he was now, a knobby, faceless, melted memory of a man, arms crossed across his chest, feet together and pointed downward, eyes shining beneath his heavy brow like a pair of cold blue moons.
A new Yogoi arose.
Several pictures showed the Yogoi nest expanding and growing, with Raynar supervising the construction of irrigation aqueducts and a drying oven.
Before, only the nest mattered. But Yogoi is smart. Yogoi learned the value of the individual, and Yogoi grew stronger.
Then came the crucial set of images. The first showed Raynar trading with other nests for food and equipment. The second depicted several insects from different nests gathered around listening to him. And in the third, he was leading an even larger group of insects, all different in color, size, and shape, off to start their own nest.
The Yunu was created.
Before he could point to another mosaic, Leia asked, "What exactly is the Yunu? The governing nest?" Raynar tilted his head and gave a short, negative click.
Not in the way you think. It is the nest of the nests, so that Yogoi may share our gift with all of the kind.
Mara asked, "What happened to the dark Jedi who abducted you?" Raynar lowered his fused brow.
The dark Jedi.
Lomi and Welk, Luke prompted. The Jedi whom you rescued on the Merkur mission.
Lomi and Welk.
Raynar's eyes grew restless.
We remember the crash, but not the Dark Jedi. We think they must be dead.
You don't remember them on the flyer at all? Luke asked. You must have seen them before you crashed. The murky presence rose inside Raynar and pushed Luke out with such power that he felt as though he were falling.
We remember the crash. We remember flames and pain and smoke. We remember fear and loneliness and despair.
The finality in Raynar's voice brought a tense silence to the dais. A silence that Han broke almost instantly when he whirled on Raynar with an outstretched finger.
What about Jaina and the others? He demanded. Do you remember them?
Of course. They were our friends. That is why we called them.
Were? Han stepped toward Raynar. Has something happened? If you're trying to make joiners of them... Han! Leia stopped Han with a gesture, then turned to Raynar. Well?
The colony has need of them. Only Jedi can prevent a war with the Chiss.
The Chiss have told us that there is a border conflict, Luke said. But not why. Raynar's scar-stiffened face showed twitches of suspicion.
We do not know why. The system we have entered is over a light year from the nearest Chiss base, and we have established nests only on food sources. Their explorers are alone on all the ore planets. We have even offered to work in their mines in exchange for food and supplies.
Let me guess, Han said from the edge of the dais. The Chiss aren't interested.
Worse, they have poisoned our food worlds. Our nests are starving, and we do not understand why.
Were it not for the golden gleam of C-3PO's head, bobbing along through a forest of feathery antennae as he questioned their guide about the colony languages, Leia would never have been able to tell which scarlet-headed insect they were following. The passage took a sharp bend, and Leia lost sight of C-3PO. Waving the others to follow, she started to walk faster. What's the hurry? Han said, catching her by the arm. We could use a few minutes alone. Alone? Leia tipped her head at the steady stream of insects clattering past. Take a look around. Han was careful to avoid doing as she suggested, but gave a little shudder anyway. You know what I mean. Without Raynar's spy listening in, I've got a plan. Plans are good, Saba agreed from the back of the group. But we don't want to look suspicious, Mara said. She waved the group forward again, and they set off with Leia and Han in the lead, Luke and Mara next, and Saba bringing up the rear. Let's keep moving while we talk. I'm pretty sure I can talk Jude into giving us a copy of that list of nests on his datapad and any charts he does have on the colony, Han said. Between that and your Jedi senses, it shouldn't take us that long to figure out where Jaina and the others are. After all, Raynar practically told us where to look, a light year or so from the frontier. If he was being honest, Mara said. He was always clever. But now, we should be careful. And that's why we should accept his offer to stay on Yogoi for a while, Leia said. They rounded the bend in the corridor, and Leia spotted C-3PO's golden head 15 meters ahead. We need to learn as much about Raynar and the colony as he knows about us. We know enough, Han grumbled. We know that Raynar joined minds with a bunch of bugs, and if we don't get to Jaina and Jason and the others soon, the same thing's going to happen to them. Han, we have time, Luke said. A Jedi's mind is not easily dominated. Oh yeah? Han glanced back. Raynar was a Jedi. A much younger and inexperienced Jedi. And a grievously wounded one, Mara said. Luke and Leia are right. We need to answer some questions before we go.
Yes, Saba said.
This one would like to know why they are lying about the Dark Jedi.
Mara nodded. I noticed that too. They came to the divide in the passage and started down the right-hand branch. C-3PO and the guide were waiting about 5 meters ahead. The guide droned.
Yogoi asks that you please try to keep up.
C-3PO translated.
And she politely suggests that you start your investigations at the crash. That way, you can see for yourself that Yulu Thul is not lying about the Dark Jedi. Or anything else.
Leia's stomach tightened in surprise, but she wasted no effort trying to figure out how the insect knew what they had been discussing. Instead, she smiled calmly and said, That sounds like an excellent idea, Yogoi. Thank you for the suggestion. By the time they reached the hangar a few minutes later, another Yogoi was waiting for them with a battered hover sled. It explained, pointing toward the shadow with one of its four arms.
Oh, dear.
C-3PO exclaimed.
It seems that when Yogoi attempted to collect Ben, Nana threatened to open fire.
I apologize, Yogoi, Luke said, addressing the